They said he was a leader, a healer, a man who spoke like truth wrapped in silk. But behind his charisma was a system. I went in to expose him. I came out unsure if I still existed. My name is Redacted, and this is not a documentary. It's a survival log. You're about to hear how I was studied, broken, and reprogrammed by a man who doesn't just manipulate people, he calibrates them. Welcome to the dark side of charisma. The question isn't whether it's real. The question is, are you already under its spell? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. They always come wrapped in silk. The worst stories I've ever chased, the darkest secrets, the most ethically bankrupt schemes, never arrive as warnings. They arrive with a smile, a handshake, a perfectly worded email. That's how this one started. It was a Tuesday morning in early spring, and the city outside my Jersey apartment still smelled like melting snow and delivery fumes. I was stirring day-old coffee when I saw the subject line. Feature pitch, Ethan Marlowe, the future of ethical leadership? I'd heard of him, of course. Everyone had. Former motivational speaker turned activist turned corporate whisperer turned, apparently, political contender. A man whose voice could shift a room, whose eyes made people talk like they'd known him forever. The pitch came from his PR manager. Polished, professional, and just vague enough to raise questions. They were inviting me to shadow Ethan for 30 days, documentary style. Full access. Private estate. Daily interviews. It had all the hallmarks of a setup, but also the scent of a byline that could make a career, or destroy one. I clicked reply. I said yes. The car they sent for me was black on black. Interior smelled like fresh eucalyptus and overpriced leather. Driver said nothing. Just nodded and tapped twice on the wheel when I asked if I could record the trip. I took that as a no. The drive out to Hunterdon County was long enough for doubt to set in. I pulled up my notes. Ethan's influence had exploded since the pandemic, from viral videos about emotional sovereignty to founding a retreat-based think tank called True Influence. His seminars sold out in minutes. His app had over 6 million users. And now, rumors swirled he was positioning himself for a U.S. Senate run. What made it dangerous wasn't just his ideas. It was how perfectly tailored they were for the moment. Emotional burnout, political distrust, digital chaos. He offered clarity in the fog. But charisma like that always hides something. And it was my job to find it. His estate looked like something out of a psychology thriller. Long private road. Black iron gates. A minimalist mansion wrapped in white concrete and wood grain. Floor-to-ceiling glass. It was clinical luxury, not warm, not cold. Just designed. A woman greeted me at the door. Red blazer, tight bun, no name. She spoke softly. Phones are to be left in this lockbox. Ethan values full presence. I asked if I could use my audio gear. He smiled, tight. Approved devices only. We'll sync you. I felt my heartbeat slip into a faster rhythm. Mind racing. A tingle of violation at the edges. But I handed it over. I'd been inside enough closed systems to know the cost of admission. They escorted me to a private guest room. All wood, no sharp corners, no clocks. There was a copy of Ethan's book on the nightstand, Mastering Leadership Through Vulnerability. The dedication inside read, "To those who've surrendered their illusions, you are the real architects." The first time I saw him was at sunset. He was standing barefoot on the back deck, overlooking a grove of cedar trees. He turned as I approached, like he already knew I was behind him. He smiled. Not like a politician. More like someone who already had your secrets, and didn't need to weaponize them yet. "Welcome," he said, his voice calm but deliberate. "I've been looking forward to this." I extended my hand. He didn't take it. Instead, he looked at me, not in a greeting but in assessment. The silence stretched just long enough to feel intentional. Then he said, "You're carrying questions you haven't made peace with. That's good. Curiosity is the fuel here." He gestured toward the house. "Come, let's begin." Later that night, I was given a digital wristband. It synced my location, vitals, and access permissions. The tech was proprietary, they called it body intelligence enhancement. I called it surveillance. I wandered the corridors. Everything was controlled. The lighting, the scent, even the ambient audio. A faint hum of binaural tones designed to regulate breath. Audio manipulation masked as wellness. Then I heard it. A conversation, muffled, tense. Coming from a server room at the end of the East Hall. A locked door. Flickering red light inside. Two male voices. One said, "She's not just a reporter. She's intuitive. You'll have to calibrate her differently." The second voice. I swear it was Ethan's. That night I couldn't sleep. Not because I was afraid, but because for the first time in my career, I wasn't sure if I was the hunter or the prey. There's a moment manipulators wait for. Not when you agree with them, that's easy. Not when you admire them, that's predictable. The moment they wait for is when your body betrays your intellect. When your pupils dilate, when your breath shortens in their presence, when your inner alarms go off, and you silence them anyway. That's when they know they have you. It happened to me in the garden, 3 days into the assignment. Ethan had this ritual. Morning walks through his meditation path, a spiraled gravel trail surrounded by ornamental grass and soft wind chimes. He invited me to join. I told myself it was part of the job. Observe, record, stay in control. But control is slippery when you're around someone who doesn't break eye contact. Not because they're aggressive, but because they see through you like glass. He asked questions that shouldn't have made me feel anything but did. Do you dream more now that you're here? Have you ever been in love with someone you couldn't write about? What's the worst lie you've ever told yourself in print? I deflected. That's what I do. But his voice, it wrapped around mine like heat. That afternoon he asked to do our first on-camera interview. The crew was two of his people. Quiet, quick, alert. The set was his library. All dark wood, soft chair, soft lighting, no distractions. Just him and me, two microphones, and a strategically placed crystal sphere that caught every sliver of light. He leaned forward, fingers steepled, and said, "Let's begin with the lie that made you a journalist." I blinked. "Excuse me." He smiled. "We all have one. A story we told ourselves to justify chasing shadows. For me, it was believing my trauma gave me insight. It didn't. It just gave me pattern recognition." He leaned closer. "Fears. It's deeper. I can see it in your jawline tension. The restraint. Your ethical standards are hiding something." Every camera was rolling, and I felt naked. He wasn't exposing my past, he was constructing a new version of it in real time and daring me to disprove it. And that's how the manipulation works. It's not force. It's co-authorship. He made me feel like I was helping him build the truth. That evening, someone left a gift on my bed. A leather-bound journal, hand-stitched, with a fountain pen tucked into its spine. Inside, I found pages already filled in my own handwriting. Words I'd written years ago. Journal entries from college, therapy intake notes, unsubmitted essays. Things no one should have. Things I never uploaded anywhere. I flipped through them with my breath caught in my ribs. The final page was blank except for a single phrase in Ethan's handwriting. "Write what you were too scared to remember." I confronted him the next morning in the main atrium. Glass above, soft echo beneath our feet. "How did you get this?" I asked, holding the journal like a loaded weapon. He didn't flinch. He didn't even look surprised. "I don't take from people," he said calmly. "I hold what they discard." Then he stepped closer, lowered his voice. "You've been broadcasting your pain for years. Through tone. Through posture. Through punctuation." He tapped the side of my head lightly. "True body intelligence. We listen with more than ears here." That night, I locked the journal in my suitcase. But it didn't help. Because now, the real question wasn't how he got inside my mind. The question was, why did it feel like he'd always been there? Every manipulator has a spotlight. But what tells you who they really are, is the shadow it casts. That shadow. The people just behind the curtain, the ones who orbit close enough to glow but never far enough to escape. That's where the truth lives. And dies. That's where I was headed next. On the fourth day, I was formally introduced to the inner circle. They didn't call themselves that, of course. It was always phrased like a coincidence. Some of Ethan's closest friends are joining us tonight. Just a small group of aligned thinkers. Only those who've earned clarity. We gathered in what they called the listening room. Soft stone walls, no windows, fire pit in the center. A dozen people, all perfectly composed. Expensive but earthy. Men in slate-gray button-ups, women in cashmere wraps. Not flashy, just surgically curated. They welcomed me with open arms, smiles, compliments, and a chilling uniformity. They all spoke the same way, like they'd been trained in language techniques built for performance. Soft, deliberate, rhythmic. One woman named Celeste caught my eye. She was magnetic, sharp cheekbones, calm voice, the kind of face you'd trust with a secret. But when I mentioned Ethan's old books, his first, more radical theories on persuasion methods and market psychology, she visibly tensed. Just for a second. Her fingers curled tight around her wine glass before she smiled again. They were early drafts of his becoming, she said. We don't dwell on drafts. Later that night, the mood shifted. We were led into the main gallery, a cavernous room with a domed ceiling and soft amber lighting. A single phrase projected across the far wall in block white letters. True influence requires true vulnerability. Everyone was handed a card. Each card had a question written in clean, centered serif text. What moment shaped your view of power? What part of your story have you never told aloud? What part of you have you allowed to remain untouched? One by one, they answered. In front of the group. No interruptions. It wasn't forced, it was encouraged. Framed as bravery. Emotional clarity. Body intelligence. Then it was my turn. My card read, "What would your father never forgive you for?" I froze. I hadn't spoken to my father in 7 years. And somehow Ethan had found the exact fracture in my timeline. "I'm just here to observe," I said, trying to smile. But the group didn't break rhythm. Ethan nodded as if that was expected. "Observation is a form of participation," he said. "Even silence tells the story." After the session, as people drifted away, a man brushed past me. Slipped something into my coat pocket. I waited until I was back in my room to check. It was a burner phone. Prepaid. One text was already open. From an unknown number. "They watch everything. Don't trust the cameras. Don't trust your own reactions. You're not just here to write a story. You're the next one." Attached was a photo. It showed a woman, mid-30s, sharp brown eyes, in the same listening room. Sitting exactly where I had sat. The message read. Her name was Laurel. She vanished last fall. I locked my door. Shoved a chair under the handle. And sat for hours just watching the walls. Waiting for them to blink. Because now I understood. This wasn't a story about a man. It was a story about gravity. About the people who orbit too close. And get pulled apart. Charisma isn't a personality trait. It's a weaponized interface. Clean, persuasive, frictionless. And when you stare at it long enough, you forget it's running a program underneath. Ethan didn't need to manipulate people face to face. He'd already built the operating system. The day after the burner phone, I slipped out of the estate under the excuse of needing creative space in town. No one questioned me, which felt like the first red flag. Either they were confident I'd come back, or they didn't care if I didn't. I drove into a nearby township, Franklin Hills. Quiet, middle-upper class. It had all the signs of recent gentrification. Boutique crystal shops next to liquor stores, kombucha cafes beside barbed wire laundromats. But every fifth window had one thing in common. Ethan Marlowe's face. Posters. Event flyers. Speaking engagements. It wasn't just his face. It was the message. Redesigning success. Rewiring influence. Reclaiming power. It was branded like a movement. But it moved like a machine. I visited a local therapist who used to host Ethan's early wellness retreats. A woman named Dr. Rona Ellis. Mid-40s. Soft-spoken. She recognized his charm. Had even defended it once. But when I brought up True Influence, his digital program, she went still. "He calls it ethical," she said. "But I've seen the backend. The modules are based on cognitive priming, shadow truths, emotional disarmament, group behavior modulation. You don't give people tools to protect themselves. You teach them to stop asking questions." When I asked for documentation, she hesitated, then said, "Meet me tomorrow. Somewhere off-grid. I don't trust this office anymore." She never showed. By morning, her voicemail was full, her social media wiped, and her license page marked, temporarily inactive. Back at the estate, Ethan acted like nothing had changed. He greeted me at breakfast. Soft robe, herbal tea, that unbearable stillness that always made him seem one step ahead. "I hope your trip gave you clarity," he said, as if he'd choreographed my doubt. He reached for a spoon and stirred his tea slowly. Sometimes it's not about what people say. It's about who disappears after they say it. I tried to upload a file that night, an encrypted voice note for my editor just in case, but my laptop wouldn't connect. My backup Wi-Fi stick, dead. Even my email credentials triggered a lockout warning. Account flagged for unusual behavior. And my phone? Still locked in the box downstairs. That's when I noticed it. The blinking red light above the bedroom mirror. Too dim to catch at first glance. But now that I knew to look, unmistakable. A surveillance node. I took a step back. Another red dot blinked from the ceiling corner. They weren't watching me. They were recording a case study. I confronted one of Ethan's staff, a young man named Lucas who'd been polite to me since day one. Cornered him by the koi pond after dusk. "What are the cameras for?" I asked. He froze. His smile flickered. Then he said, "You're being calibrated." So, Ethan believes that before someone leads, they must be fully witnessed. Is that what happened to Laurel? His eyes went dead. His voice flatlined. "I don't know who that is. But I saw the tremor in his hands. They always know who vanished." Back in my room, I heard something. A soft chime from the wall tablet that controlled lights and ambient audio. A message was waiting. "System update complete. Phase 1 calibration successful." Followed by a prompt. "Would you like to begin phase 2? I didn't touch it. Didn't sleep. Didn't blink for hours. Because somewhere between the burner phone, the vanishing therapist, and the red lights breathing over my bed, I realized I wasn't here to expose the system. I was in it. They say obedience is born from fear. But that's only part of it. The more dangerous kind is born from belonging." That's how Ethan worked. He didn't rule through dominance. He ruled through need. After the phase 2 prompt, I didn't leave my room for 2 days. I faked a stomach flu, refused food, kept the lights dim, and still, they sent someone. Celeste knocked once, waited, then spoke through the door. "Ethan's worried you're not integrating properly. He'd like to offer you an optional calibration session. One-on-one. Safe. Voluntary. Grounded in body awareness and trust psychology." Her voice was smooth, not persuasive but pre-accepted. Like a decision already made. I declined. She waited. Then slid a note under the door. "Resisting influence is the first sign you've already been influenced." That night I cracked. Not in some dramatic, tearful collapse. I just stopped fighting the current. I left the room. Walked into the atrium barefoot, not knowing why. The place was empty. Music drifted from somewhere. Layered frequencies engineered for calm. Audio manipulation designed to bypass resistance. I sat on the floor. And waited. Ethan found me like he always did. As if summoned by silent need. He didn't sit. He crouched beside me, hands open, gaze level. "You're exhausted because you're still trying to narrate this as journalism," he said. "But what if this is just emotional exploration? What if you stopped assigning motives and just felt what you were becoming?" I didn't answer. I didn't have one. "Would you like me to show you what obedience really is?" he asked, his voice like warm glass. "Not control. Not domination. Just the removal of conflict." He led me to the reflection room. All mirrors, one chair, one camera. "Sit," he said gently. I did. He stood behind me out of frame. "Tell the camera what you believe about yourself. Not the words you publish. The ones that crawl through your chest when the lights go out." It started as resistance. Then, something broke open. I said things I hadn't said aloud in years. About my father. About being underestimated. About the part of me that used truth to punish people. About how I used stories to pretend I wasn't still grieving the version of myself I never became. Afterwards, he didn't comment. Didn't judge. He just touched my shoulder and whispered, "You've now obeyed yourself. That's the hardest obedience of all." I left the room in silence. Felt lighter. Disoriented. More cracked open than manipulated. That's when I realized. He didn't need to control my actions. He just had to reroute my compass. The next morning, I saw Celeste crying on the west lawn. She was alone. Knees folded to her chest. Shoulders shaking. I walked up. Said nothing. After a long pause, she whispered, "He told me my fear was a doorway, that if I walked through it, I'd find love on the other side." I sat next to her. She pulled something from her sweater, a necklace. Inside the locket was a photo of a baby. My daughter. Haven't seen her in 2 years. He said she's part of my old identity. That love, real love, must be untethered. She looked at me with bloodshot eyes. I believed him. I still do on the good days. Back in my room, I replayed the footage of myself in the reflection room. My voice sounded alien. Too soft. Too trusting. But what scared me more was that I didn't hate who I sounded like. That's the genius of obedience. It doesn't break you. It lets you believe you evolved. Obedience is a slow rot. You don't notice it until the floor gives out beneath you. And by then you're so deep in the structure you forget what freedom sounded like. I remembered that sound. It was my own voice. Unfiltered, doubtful, angry. It haunted me in the silence between Ethan's truths. That's when I knew I had to get out. Not for the story. For myself. I waited for nightfall. Kept the lights off in my room. Moved in shadows. The digital wristband on my arm was still synced to the estate's body intelligence system, tracking vitals, location, and compliance patterns. I needed to disable it, but without triggering a health alert. I used a trick I learned from a data scientist years ago. Slow my breathing, flatten my pulse, stay perfectly still. It mimicked sleep, long enough for the system to drop my priority flag. Then I slipped it off and flushed it down the guest bathroom sink. I took the back stairwell. Not the main hallway, it had surveillance. Too obvious. The exit door was alarmed. But the burner phone I'd hidden under the loose floorboard in the meditation room had a code. 1187, Ethan's birth year reversed. Laurel had written it in the text thread before she vanished. I keyed it in. The lock clicked open. I stepped outside and heard it for the first time in days. Wind. No artificial tones. No guided meditation. Just the real world. I made it to the edge of the estate. No lights. No guards. Just a black gravel path that snaked toward the forest. That's when I saw them. Two motion sensor drones. Low hum. Blue lights flashing as they pivoted. Surveillance tech. Not defense. Meant to track, not capture. I dropped to the ground. Crawled. Stayed in blind spots. Made it to the trees. Ran. My contact was waiting. An ex-military tech analyst named V, one of the few people who still trusted me enough to help. We met at an off-grid cafe in an industrial part of New Brunswick. She looked me over like I was a file she'd been assigned to decrypt. You look like shit, she said. I laughed. First time in days. I need to leak everything, I told her. Recordings, documents, facial scans, all of it. He pulled out a drive. I've already got backdoor access to their internal comms, she said. They use a split encryption system. Half local, half cloud-based. Their server room is the key. I froze. The server room. The one I'd overheard on my first night. The one Ethan's voice had whispered behind. We built the plan in less than an hour. Fake re-entry. Hidden mic signal hijack. I was going back in, not as a journalist. As bait. But before I left, V handed me something. A manila folder. Inside were printed screenshots, pulled from the estate's internal logs. Calibrated personality models. Names, photos, emotional profiles. Hundreds of them. I flipped to the last page. There was my face. Underneath it. Subject 94. High influence susceptibility. Recommended conversion. Emotional repatterning via audio looping. The signature at the bottom wasn't Ethan's. It was mine. Forged. But perfect. They were already writing my ending. All I had left was to rewrite it louder. Every story has a breaking point. A moment when the narrator, me, stops reporting and starts unraveling. This was mine. Reentry was a performance. I returned to the estate just after sunrise, wearing soft tones, neutral posture, no questions in my voice. Ethan met me in the atrium. No tension. No interrogation. Only a small nod and 6 quiet words. You needed the contrast. I understand. That's how he framed everything. Even rebellion was part of the program. The next 48 hours blurred. No one watched me. No one followed me. And that, somehow made it worse. Because I'd seen behind the curtain. And the silence wasn't ignorance. It was confidence. Ethan invited me to a small gathering. Just 4 of us, trusted minds, he said. A circle of calibrated trust. We sat in a soundproof room, soft lighting, no devices. Only a speaker playing ambient frequencies, just low enough to feel not here. He began talking about obedience again. About emotional recalibration, social engineering, cognitive behavior remapping. Then he turned to me. "We've reached phase three," he said. "You're ready for closure." I laughed out loud. "Closure?" I said. "I haven't even opened the story yet." Ethan just smiled. "You've already written it. You just don't remember." He handed me a file. Thin. No label. Inside. Transcripts. Of me. Speaking. Confessing. Admitting things I've never said aloud. Things I didn't remember saying. I didn't love him. I used trauma for credibility. I envy the people I expose. I flipped through the pages. Each one time-stamped. Recorded. Logged into a system labeled. PS1. Psychological submission phase 1. That night I broke. Not dramatically. Not with screaming or shattering glass. Just slowly. My mind began glitching. Faces melted into each other. Words echoed. I couldn't remember if I'd recorded certain scenes, or dreamed them. I woke up with scratches on my arms. 3 parallel lines. Not deep, but deliberate. Like reminders. I stood in front of the mirror and whispered to my reflection, "You are not a subject. You are not a subject. You are not." A voice behind me. "You're evolving." I spun around. No one was there. The final blow came the next morning. V went dark. Our comms line, dead. Encrypted drives, wiped. And a package arrived in my room. No return label. Inside, a cassette tape. Written across it in sharp black marker. Phase 2. Audio conditioning. Subject 94. Confession ready. I played it. Of course I did. It was my voice. Soft. Hypnotized. Panical. I trust Ethan. I was lost before him. I'm not being manipulated. I'm being healed. It repeated. And again. My voice reduced to obedience code. Audio warfare in my own tone. I collapsed that night. Couldn't tell dream from memory. Reality felt like a movie script someone else was revising. I lay on the floor for hours, eyes open, whispering fragments of my own notes to hold on to something real. Because once they can manipulate your voice, they can rewrite your mind. You can only stay broken for so long. Eventually, the mind fights back, even if it's barely holding together. Even if you don't trust your thoughts anymore. Even if your voice has been stolen and weaponized. Because manipulation isn't just about control. It's about timing. And this was mine. I came back online the same way I'd gone offline. Quietly. No announcement. No rebellion. Just small acts of reversal. First, I reset the light panel in my room to blink in Morse. A code V and I used years ago during whistleblower coverage. Second, I tapped into the audio loop system and embedded white noise artifacts in the ambient tracks. Distortions I could track later. Third, I reactivated the pendant I wore on my press tours. A piece of smart jewelry that doubled as a hidden camera with a live uplink. I sent one message through the corrupted server line. Subject 94 active. Upload imminent. Trust nothing. Then I said yes to Ethan. Yes to phase 3. Yes to the final alignment. Yes to the camera. I let him record me again, sitting in the reflection room looking hollow, obedient, calibrated. I played the part of a woman ready to be rebranded. To become one of his disciples. To sell influence under the guise of ethical clarity. But I had one condition. I want to do a live stream. One final interview before I commit. Let the world see the real me. He agreed. Of course he did. He loved the spotlight. And he thought he'd already won. The day of the broadcast, I sat across from him in the estate's private media lounge. Minimalist lighting. Earth tones. Soft music just beneath the frequency of hearing. He smiled at me like a father proud of his star pupil. Ready to tell the world the truth? I looked directly into the lens, nodded, and said, "I've been manipulated. But no. I know how it works. And so will you." Then I reached under the table, pressed the pendant twice, and unlocked every suppressed file V had cached remotely. Audio confessions. Hidden surveillance. Calibrated subject lists. Ethan's exact manipulation methodology, labeled under folders like Mind Architecture, obedience loops, PS1, PS5 case progressions, cognitive collapse and consent mapping, and most damning of all, a document labeled laurelanddetermination.pdf. The screen behind us flickered. Files spilled across the stream in real time. The audience count jumped from hundreds to tens of thousands in minutes. Ethan stayed still. Then he smiled. Not fear. Recognition. I always hoped it would be you, he said. You're better when you're fighting. He leaned toward the camera, calm as ever. But remember this. Truth is just another tool. And I taught you how to use it. Then the screen went black. Just for a moment. Then the live stream restarted, but not from our camera. From a different angle. Someone inside the estate, one of the inner circle, had turned their own camera against him. The frame showed Ethan walking out of the room, surrounded by his staff, whispering instructions. Real-time footage. Unfiltered. One voice in the background said, "Initiate clean protocol. Subject 94 is unstable." Another said, "Too late. She's activated the cascade. I went underground immediately. V pulled me out through a side corridor, into a back road escape route pre-planned weeks earlier. I didn't take my bag. Didn't take my laptop. Just the pendant. And the drive. As we drove away, I looked out the window. The estate glowed in the rearview mirror. Silent. So, like a temple after the god inside it has been exposed as a man. I didn't feel triumphant. Just awake. And I knew the storm was coming. Because Ethan didn't run. He didn't hide. He smiled. As if this had all been part of the show. They didn't come for me with handcuffs. Or threats. Or smear campaigns. They came for me with silence. The live stream went viral for 9 minutes. 9 minutes of truth. 9 minutes of names, files, tactics, broken trust, and exposed obedience architecture. Nothing. The video was scrubbed. Mirrored files disappeared. Links redirected to meditation ads. When I logged into my account the next morning, I got a message from the platform. This content violates our guidelines for misinformation and harassment. Your channel has been deactivated pending review. Review never came. My editor didn't answer. My backup drives were encrypted without my keys. The burner phone V had given me rang once. Then fried. And the worst part? Ethan released a statement. He thanked the concerned journalist for highlighting their experimental resilience program. Said her emotional volatility was proof the program triggered deep healing. Then he smiled into the camera and said, "The world doesn't fear manipulation. It fears what happens when we stop pretending we're not all part of it." He spun it. Brilliantly. The comments under his video were flooded with hashtags. Hashtag healing truth. Hashtag easy. Hashtag rebuild the narrative. Hashtag charisma cures. The people, the ones I thought I was protecting, defended him. One woman wrote. She just couldn't handle transformation. Not everyone can survive the mirror. I tried reaching out to other outlets. No response. I tried an underground whistleblower site. They told me they were already compromised. I contacted my old podcast network. They had just signed Ethan for a self-improvement series. They wished me well and blocked me. A week passed. Then I moved 3 times, cut my hair, changed my name on rental papers, burned every hard copy I had. And then it happened. An envelope arrived under my new door. No stamp. No return address. Inside, a single photo of me, taken that morning, time stamped, and in the corner, handwritten in black ink. Still evolving. That night, I sat in the dark and played the audio from my pendant. Not the live stream. Not the files. Just one clip. Me whispering to myself in the mirror before I broke. You are not a subject. You are not a subject. You are not. But I never finished the last line. Because somewhere inside me, I wasn't sure anymore. There's a kind of silence that doesn't mean peace. It means erasure. Not the kind that deletes your memories. The kind that rewrites them. Makes your story feel like someone else's fiction. That's where I live now. Between memory and manipulation. Between witness and warning. It's been 4 months since the broadcast. 4 months since I vanished from the feed. And Ethan? He didn't disappear. He evolved. The system absorbed the scandal like it was part of the brand. He announced a new tech partnership. True Influence AI. A social clarity algorithm backed by private equity and disguised as ethical marketing. He booked interviews with influencers, thought leaders, and political hopefuls, all of them smiling, nodding, repeating his language like it was gospel. Obedience now automated. I watched a segment last week. He called what happened to me a symbolic fracture in the collective narrative. Then said, "Sometimes we need someone to break, to teach the rest of us how not to." And the room applauded. I stopped speaking to anyone after that. Until today, this recording, what you're hearing now, is the only version of me I haven't had to censor. No platforms, no filters, just my voice and yours. If you're listening, you've likely felt it too. That strange pull when someone walks into a room and speaks with too much certainty. That warmth that wraps around your ribs before your mind catches up. That charisma that feels like sunlight until it burns. I thought I could expose it. What I learned is this. Charisma is not light. It's not love. It's not strength. It's a mirror. And if you don't know who you are before you step into it, you'll believe whatever reflection they give you. Somewhere, right now, another story is starting. Another voice is being softened. Another truth, being curated. Because charisma never stops. It just waits for the next you.